This podcast is a part of Sphera,
a collective of independent media outlets from across Europe.
For more information,
visit sphera-hub.com.
It's coming home. It's coming home. It's coming. As you may have gathered, I have decided at very late stage, Dominic, to get into the Euro Championship. I get football now. Are you happy for me?
You're just a glory hunter.
Well, now that we're winning, I'm interested.
Yeah. By we, you mean England, I presume, even though you live in France.
Well, this is the weird thing about the Euro, isn't it? Because, like, on the one hand, it does feel like a very nice shared European moment, but it is also incredibly nationalistic and encourages us all to be reduced to like pathetic flag waving.
Someone was saying to me the other day that they think it's like a healthy outlet for pent up nationalism that we all have.
Interesting.
I think Eurovision is a healthier outlet personally, but I am still really enjoying Euro 2020 in 2021.
Actually, by the time that you hear this, England could well have left the tournament.
That's true. Like,
newfound English nationalism could be really outdated.
Yeah, we're recording before the match, but yeah, nervously awaiting what's going to happen. Yeah, I noticed you'd suddenly tuned in because you were posting on our Patreon group about how you'd seen a Gazprom advert.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, they've been there since the group rounds, Katie. I've noticed you've just tuned in at the quarterfinals, but fine.
I haven't been there since the group rounds. Sorry. Anyway, football aside, what's happening this week?
Well, this week I need to give a little gluten warning. Apologies to any celiacs out there, because we're going to be talking about bread. We are calling up Apollonia Poilen, the third generation French-American baker, whose bakery, Poilen, is one of the world's most celebrated bakeries. Her family bakery is especially famed for its sourdough bread, which of course has seen a huge pandemic boom. So we'll be discussing the mysterious magic of sourdough and her extraordinary family heritage of bread later on in the show. But first, we've got a very internet-y good week, bad week for you.
Oh yeah, I'm actually delighted to tell you all that I started a new job this week. I'm internet correspondent now for AFP, which is very exciting. And so we thought we'd do a very special internet-flavoured edition of your favourite segment to celebrate that.
We can't do this every week. It can't just become a podcast about the internet.
Why not?
Who's had a bad week, Katie, on the internet?
It has been a bad week for the Swedish supermarket chain Co-op. At the time of recording, hundreds of their stores have been closed for 3 days now because of a massive cyber attack targeting a software company based in Miami. We are recording this late Tuesday. Hopefully, by the time that you hear this on Thursday, all of the shops will be open for business again. But I think we can still say it's been a rubbish week for them. This cyber attack has wiped out the cash registers of this Swedish supermarket chain for multiple days now.
Can't they just bring out the abacus and start like doing it, calculating everything manually?
Oh, Dominic. I guess we can't all be tech correspondents, but how backwards of you?
It's actually affected a lot of other companies in Europe too. It's not just American companies and the Co-op in Sweden. In fact, I've got a kitchen that's meant to be being delivered that's like the most middle-aged thing I've ever said. And it's being delayed because of this hack.
Yeah, it does seem to have really been pretty massive. And the thing that's really interesting about it, I feel like I've become a sort of massive cybersecurity nerd over the past couple of days because of this story, so forgive me. The thing that's really interesting is that it shows that by attacking a random, quite boring sounding company that not many people have heard of, this software company called Kaseya, these hackers have been able to attack businesses all over the world, an estimated 1,500 companies in at least 17 countries. Co-op in Sweden are the most visible of these victims because it's a massive supermarket chain and it's pretty crazy that they've had to shut all their stores for 3 days, possibly more. But most of the victims are like small businesses, pharmacies, gas stations. There are even a bunch of kindergartens in New Zealand that had to go offline because of this. It's really, really big in scale.
This is ransomware, right? I sometimes get confused between like all the different types of hacks.
Yeah, so this is what's called a ransomware attack, which is basically a hostage taking. So what happens when you're the victim of a ransomware attack is that the hackers lock up your data, they encrypt it, and then they're like, well, we'll give it back to you, but you're going to have to pay for it. And this is something that's been really, really increasing in recent years. It's actually quite a good business. I might get into it.
Stop there.
But in this case, the hackers hit this boring IT company, Kaseya, a US company. And the reason that they targeted this company is that it sells IT management software to loads of other companies, like 40,000 of them. And lots of those companies are in turn IT companies that manage the computers of other businesses, which means that lots of the victims are a couple of steps removed from the original company in Miami. Mm. So the Co-op supermarket, for example, it's not a direct customer of Kaseya. It has nothing to do with them. But Co-op uses a Swedish IT company to manage all of its computer stuff, and they got hit. And that's why this attack has managed to be so far-reaching. It really shows just how interconnected companies' infrastructure can be because of tech companies like this one.
So the general idea is that the hackers want money in order to, like, reopen the websites again. That's such, I really shouldn't be a tech correspondent ever.
Leave it to me. Stick with your abacus. Yeah, and in this case, the hackers have asked for a rather eye-catching sum of money. They put a post on the dark web. You know what the dark web is, right?
I've heard of it.
They put a post on the dark web saying, yes, it was us who did this. And if you want your data back, you're going to have to give us $70 million in Bitcoin. Usually, depending on the size of the company, hackers ask for like maybe $5 million if it's a pretty big company, or maybe something a lot smaller, like $50,000. So this is a pretty brash thing to do. And cybersecurity experts are a bit puzzled about why they've asked for this massive lump sum of money. It's pretty unprecedented. Apparently, ransomware hackers have got really good at researching their victims and looking at like their insurance policies and saying, oh, okay, this company can probably afford to give us this amount. And there is some suggestion that the hackers behind last week's attack are approaching individual victims and saying, give us $50,000 or like give us $1 million for your bit of the data back. But this idea of requesting a lump sum from like all or any of the victims of $70 million, it's a bit weird. It's not like all of these international companies are going to like get together and discuss this, you know? So it feels like a bit of a stunt.
Do we know who's done it? Do we know who's behind this attack?
So this is the other interesting element of the story. There is a Russian connection.
Mm.
The ransom claim for $70 million in Bitcoin, it was posted on a site with the rather charming name of Happy Blog, which is just adorable.
Oh, cute.
And this is a site on the dark web, which is associated with a Russian-speaking hacking group called Reval. We don't know if they're actually Russian or not. They might be somewhere else in the region. And these guys are like ransomware geniuses. I read a report yesterday from IBM, which reckons that they were responsible for nearly a third of the world's ransomware attacks last year. They made about $123 million off it.
Whoa.
Because companies often just pay up. They need their data back. And there was actually a really high-profile example of that last month. There's this Brazilian company called JBS. They're one of the biggest meat processors in the world. And they got hit by Reval. And they ended up just paying the hackers to get their stuff back. $11 million.
It's amazing that companies haven't found a way to prevent this. Like, there aren't big security systems in place yet.
I mean, there are, but they don't always work.
But wasn't there something with this story that there were some Dutch good, in inverted commas, hackers who were, like, onto them?
Yes, and helped raise the alarm. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, helped raise the alarm, but just didn't quite get there in time.
Apparently too late for this Swedish supermarket chain, sadly, and yeah, many other victims besides.
And so you say they're Russian-speaking, but mm-hmm. is there any suggestion that they're connected to the Kremlin, that this is like another one of Putin's weird new Cold War games?
Yeah, it's obviously a question that a lot of people have been asking, because this was an American company that was targeted. So as soon as Russian hackers get mentioned, it's like, ooh, is this a Kremlin thing? But I had a super interesting conversation yesterday with Kieran Martin, who is a cybersecurity professor at Oxford University. And he basically said that it's really unlikely that the Kremlin would be involved in this at all. Because why would they be? Like, the Russian government doesn't really have an interest in like extorting money from small businesses. When hacking has support from the Russian state, it's generally about spying. It's about trying to get into US infrastructure and have a sneak around. And this was just about getting money. And Professor Kieran, when we were chatting yesterday, he said something really interesting, which was that he doesn't think the hackers behind this attack were part of the Russian state, but he thinks they are tolerated by the state. And that basically the rules of the game for these guys are, well, so long as you don't hit Russian companies and you don't hit Russian interests, you can do what we want. We will turn a blind eye. But if we happen to need your services, your hacking services, We know where to find you, and you will do what we tell you to. So these hacking groups like Revol, there's lots and lots of different groups like this present in Russia, and they're maybe a kind of unpredictable element to have in the country, but they're also probably a useful element to have if you're the Kremlin.
I just cannot imagine how stressful it must be for any of these companies and for the co-op. Like, oh, imagine if it just happened to your own computer. I know it does also just happen to individuals. I never want this to happen to me, please.
How much money would you pay me if you lost control of your, what's special to you, your WhatsApp?
Oh, so much money. I know how it would be you, because you'd have like ransomware with an angry Macron face.
That could be my calling card. Who has had a good week?
It's hopefully been a good week for people's body image in Norway. And in Norway, there's recently been a big public debate about body image and the effects on people from seeing all these retouched and unrealistic images of influencers and models on social media, often with like ridiculously toned looking bodies, plump lips and wrinkle-free faces. I probably don't need to explain this to people, but these altered images create a frankly false idea of what a person looks like, and they arguably exacerbate the huge and sometimes very destructive problems of body dysmorphia, low self-esteem, and eating disorders. And it's been a good week for body image because Norwegian lawmakers have taken a step towards maybe easing some of that subtle but widespread pressure that so many people feel when they spend time online.
Mm.
So it's a bill proposed by the Ministry of Children and Family Affairs, and it will soon make it mandatory for influencers who are posting sponsored posts and advertisers more broadly to acknowledge in their posts if images have been retouched. They will now not be able to secretly change the texture or colour of someone's skin. They'll not be able to alter the size of someone's thighs or give them bigger biceps. I'd like bigger biceps. Unless, you see, that's because of social media. I think I want bigger biceps, but they're fine.
They're fine.
unless they then say openly what they have done, acknowledging that they are creating a not entirely realistic portrayal of the human being who is being photographed. And the idea is that people will be embarrassed to say what they've done, so they won't do it so much.
That's quite an interesting extension of, like, in theory, like where the general culture is going. Because it feels like, in general, the culture is changing around body positivity. And like, you know, on my social media feed and in the street, I see way more adverts than I used to for like underwear where the models have stretch marks or their figures are a bit more generous. But like to try and create a sense of shame for airbrushing, that's a step further.
Yeah, and some people think it's a bit controversial because they're worried that it's going to mean that some influencers decide to opt for plastic surgery instead because they then don't have to write about that.
Mm.
And that's obviously a bigger intervention in their own body. So not everyone is a fan of this law. But it's also not the first time a law like this has existed in Europe. You may remember, Katie, that in 2017, a similar law came in France, but that was more focused towards magazines and advertising. So you're now not allowed to put a photo in a magazine in France without saying what has been airbrushed, if it has been airbrushed. And actually, you can face a fine of up to €37,500, which is quite a lot.
Wow, I didn't realize it was that high.
With the Norwegian law, there are also increasing fines and even possible jail time for repeat offenders.
Sounds like a really good idea, but like, how is this enforceable?
Yeah, it's a very good point. The ministry have acknowledged that it's going to be really difficult to enforce because indeed it's not always possible to determine whether or not a photo has been retouched. So we don't actually know that yet.
And so what do actual influencers think about all of this?
Well, I read a piece in the Norwegian paper VG that interviewed various influencers about this law, and mainly they were very supportive of it. One said she'd been waiting a long time for a law like this to come into force, and another even went as far as saying it shouldn't just apply to paid posts, but all posts from influencers, which is obviously a fair point because unpaid posts also contribute to the problem of unrealistic expectations. But then there's the question of like, how far are we infringing into people's personal social media posts? And that's a complicated question.
Mm.
And I want to stress that there is a huge problem, not just in Norway, of course, the problem of body image, particularly amongst young people and particularly amongst young girls. These images can be really damaging for people's mental health. It, of course, affects all types of people, but the statistics in Norway around body image for young girls are very striking. According to a study from the WHO, half of all 15-year-old girls in Norway think that they are fat.
Ugh, that's so sad.
Yeah, and 9% of them are considered medically obese, but it's really sad. And apparently 28% of them are either dieting or think that they should be. So it's a lot of 15-year-old girls feeling the pressure. And at the Norwegian Institute for Eating Disorders, they specifically highlight the effect of external dietary pressure from advertisements and social media. And obviously this bill alone is by no means going to eradicate the awful problems of mental illness and psychiatric disorders connected to body image, but it is a step in the right direction. And it's a sign that this big public debate in Norway around kroppspress, literally meaning body pressure, has started to have some effect.
That's really cool. I do wonder how much less anxious my generation of young women would have been about our own bodies if we'd had initiatives like this. Like, you and me grew up in an era where, I don't know if this was true for you, but at school, people would pass around these gossip magazines and there would be these features called, like, Circle of Shame. But, like, literally a red circle would be drawn around, like, a celebrity's belly if they had, like, a little bulge or something. And I just wonder if things like this would have made us feel that little bit less anxious about our bodies. I mean, I think to some extent teenagers are always going to feel horrible about their bodies, but it does seem to me like this is something that might help a little bit.
Yeah, on the other hand, I am thankful every day that I wasn't a teenager when Instagram and Facebook were around, because we didn't have to take photos of ourselves, or we weren't pressured to take photos of ourselves, which makes it even more intense, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Can you believe that we've been making this podcast for 3.5 years now?
Have we really?
Yeah. And the only reason that we're still here, making this weekly burst of Europe for your ears, is because of our amazing supporters who make it possible for us to pay for researching it and editing it. It really wouldn't exist without their generosity. And the latest amazing people to sign up and support us are Anna, Brinduza Natasa, and Keelan Hunter for a really very generous increase in his pledge.
Yeah, thank you all, and thank you everyone for continuing to support us on Patreon. You can join them by heading to patreon.com/Europeans podcast.
We love bread. I specifically love bread. It is a major reason why I continue to live in France, obviously. And I just figured, Dominic, we let you have a halloumi episode a while back. This is my week. We're having bread week.
Bread.
A couple of weeks back, Dominic and I had a wonderful conversation with Apollonia Poilen. In France, her family is really pretty famous. The Poilen bakery is synonymous with super traditional, super high quality bread. Her family has also experienced terrible tragedy. Apollonia's parents died in an accident when she was just 18. And a couple of days later, she found herself in charge of this huge company, which she's been running ever since. She has a remarkable story. And she's also just someone who loves talking about bread, possibly more than anyone I've ever spoken to. It was just a delicious conversation. I almost want to say bon appetit.
A very, maybe embarrassingly basic question to start with, but what is sourdough?
That's a really important question, Dominique. A lot of people confuse sourdough a little bit, I guess, like risotto, being only with rice versus it being a cooking technique. Sourdough is not so much a type of bread, but a technique of baking whereby instead of using yeast, we use a piece of dough from one batch that we let ferment and become the starter for the following batch. So typically at Poilen, when we bake a batch of bread, we have our big mixing bowl, the pétrin, in which we have water, one sort of a grain flour, salt, and a piece of dough from the previous batch, which we left to rest, and that serves as a starter for the following batch's fermentation. So sourdough is literally, as the name in English very adequately suggests, is a piece of dough when sour.
So that means then that the bread that is baked in your bakery, there is something in there
that dates back of 1932.
Right, exactly. That's crazy.
Yeah. So, you know, when you go down in the bakehouse, whether it's in Paris or London, and you have this piece of sourdough, It actually dates back to 1932 when my grandfather started the family business in the heart of Saint-Germain-des-Prés. And that piece of dough has been thrown into the following batch, and then a little piece was set aside of that batch for the following batch. So yes, there is that legacy. In French, you would say a fil rouge, that is that link between the previous and the next generation of bread. And it's beautiful because it's a little bit like us humans carry a little bit of our parents, but we are our own unique people and moving on generations to generations.
Does it mean that the bread you're eating tastes similar to the bread that your grandfather was making in the 1930s?
Yeah, Dominique, that's absolutely right. There is that sense that the bread my grandfather would bake is the same that my father and I today would bake, whether it's ourselves or with our teams. The bread that we're eating now, we've developed our sourdough, and over time it has become really ours. And we've been around for a little over 88 years, so we've really developed a personality.
This is going to sound extremely ignorant, but I live in France myself, and I don't tend to think of France as a sourdough country, right? Foreigners tend to think of France as a country of sort of white flour baguettes. And we think of sourdough as something that's more associated with sort of modern hipsters. But sourdough has a really, really long history in France, doesn't it?
So sourdough in France is just about as old as bread. And in fact, if the pandemic for the past year and a half has brought sourdough back in the people's top of mind, it actually has been trending for centuries, because that, until, you know, the 19th century, was the only way that we could bake bread. And so while we do now associate the French with some whiter breads of smaller formats, actually the bread that fed centuries of French, but ultimately of Europeans, was these big sourdough wheat or rye flour, essentially, breads. And it's significant because these big batches also corresponded to a period where people would eat on average around 600 to 900 grams of bread per person per day. So take one of my loaves, which I like to describe as a big hug of bread. So if you put your two hands in front of you, they'll create this sort of circle, and it gives you a little sense of the volume of my loaves. And an average French person would eat half of that every single day.
I would love to live that life.
It's madness, no?
Why can't I eat that much bread every day?
Well, we don't eat that much bread every day now because, especially post-World War II, our food has diversified and we've been able to have access to different styles of foods that were not previously as readily available. And it's a great thing because we are able, therefore, to have, you know, more nutrients from different sources. And I think that that is a beautiful thing because it then opens the way for other uses of bread, not only as an essential food, but also it can be something that really enhances your meal, like a glass of wine. But it's also something that can serve as an ingredient itself, because bread is such a versatile food. So you can turn it into a plate when you make a sandwich or a tartine. Or you can turn it into topping if you make breadcrumb or croutons to texture a salad. So bread is really this magical ingredient that we've been eating for centuries and that we've had 1,001 uses for, just because we couldn't waste it because it was so essential. And it's just also such a beautiful product.
I absolutely agree. And bread is very much synonymous with France. Mm-hmm. Why do you think the country has such a special connection and relationship with bread?
I'm not entirely sure how bread became so intrinsically linked with French culture. We haven't lost, although we've lost a lot of our bakers, we haven't lost too many of our local bakeries. There literally is in France a bakery at every street corner. And so you, as a baker, especially in cities, you're competing for customers that, you know, by literally the number of doors you live away from them. Provided you make bread that's decent, your competition comes from your fellow baker that's working down the street. And in part, that's the story of my grandfather, who, when he started in 8 rue du Cherche Midi, was surrounded by bakeries. And my father told me there were two or three other bakeries within, you know, a block or two. And my grandfather decided that he wanted to bake bread that would keep and feed you. And that was the beginning of his way of feeding his singularity and his approach to baking, really.
You took over this family business in extremely difficult circumstances. You were only 18 years old. Was there a part of you at the time that just thought, I want to just carry on being a teenager?
I took over the family business when I was 18. I was taking a year off before I went to college. And, you know, from this time I was a kid, I always knew that I would take over the family business one day. It just happened sooner than planned. And I am not trying to diminish how lucky I was to be surrounded by great colleagues, by having a business that was well organized and having friends of my parents and now my own friends to fill in where I lacked the experience but had all the knowledge that my grandfather, but mostly my father, had passed along to me growing up.
And you also did a degree at Harvard around the same time as well. That must have been quite a difficult thing to balance.
Yeah, so I was taking a year off when I took over my family's business, and I had about 10 months ahead of me to decide what I was going to do about my college admittance. And I went for 4 years going back and forth between Paris and Boston about my studies. I completed a degree in economics, and for me it was such a great way of prolonging my parents' education, to be open to the world and to discover, to be hungry for new knowledge and understanding other domains of interest. And that was for me such a fantastic education, which still today feeds me, whether it's through my former roommates, my friends, and the doors it has opened to me in meeting people.
Poilane still has this amazing reputation for excellence, but you actually don't make many different types of products, do you? And I was wondering, where does that desire to keep things simple come from? Is it a business strategy, or is it about honoring your family's heritage with this company?
So at Poilane, we bake breads, sablés, so sandy textured biscuits, and baker's pastries, so pastries that can be baked in the baker's oven. I have an approach where I look at my craft as the crossroads between grains and fermentation. In fact, if the auditors who are listening to us want to take away one thing from what I'm saying, is they should drop the word flour as an ingredient in any recipe and start talking about the grain that we're using. In the way that I look at and go about my business, it is really through that lens of these three families of products and then crossing it with, I work 7 grains in my little sablés. I have wheat, I have rye, I have corn, I have rice, I have barley, I have oats, and I have buckwheat, which is technically not a grain, but it's used as, and there's an 1/8 on the way. So I do bake daily over a dozen different types of breads, but each of them have a purpose.
Making sourdough during the pandemic has become a bit of a sort of lockdown craze, at least for people of Dominic and my age, people in their early 30s with nothing better to do. I know that you do seem to have faith that people can make something worth eating at home. You have a cookbook, you have an online masterclass. While we have you here, do you have any tips for making sourdough bread at home?
I have 2 tips, actually 3. Number 1, read my book, Poilane. I published it in both English and French. And I provide a recipe to start baking breads in a way and fashion that is not exactly the one I do at Poilane, because I have a larger production, but one that uses the same techniques and spirit, so that my readers and apprentice bakers would get their hands dirty. Baking is about tests and trials and building the intuition that you can have about gestures and consequences. There was a masterclass on the American platform that came out last December and that illustrates more of those steps. I firmly believe that while at the bakery we have a volume that allows us to create these beautiful loaves, you can still get something that echoes and or goes in that direction at home using the different techniques that I suggest. And one tip that I think is probably cookie cutter, but needs to be reminded that there's no harm in failing. I have failed so many times my recipes at home, and I don't always do a perfect loaf, and that's okay. The only thing is just try, live, learn.
You You heard the woman. If you are interested in getting into sourdough baking, even at this late stage of the pandemic, Apollonia's book is a great place to start. It is called Simply Pollen. What have you been watching this week?
Well, to be honest, I've not been that isolated these past few weeks. So this isolation inspiration feels a bit of a cheat.
Oh yeah, you've been back on the stage.
I have. I did four performances in just over 24 hours, which was really fun and thrilling and scary. But because I'm out of the house a bit more, I'm actually listening to more podcasts again, which is quite nice. I've just remembered how much I like listening to them. And I heard a great episode from EU Scream, which is a progressive political podcast about the EU from journalist James Cantor. And the latest episode looks at this hashtag Brussels so white,
oh, yeah,
which is the problem of the overwhelming whiteness of people who work in the EU institutions and particularly in the EU Commission. It's something we also made an episode about many years ago when we just started. You say 3.5 years ago. I can't believe that. But it was interesting to get an update on the state of play now, especially now that we live in the time of Black Lives Matter. And it was pretty disheartening, to be honest, actually, to hear that whilst there's been some really good progress in increasing the number of women in power, well, white women mainly, there hasn't been similar progress with racialized people. So I really recommend the latest episode of EU Scream. It's called Eurocrats Who Look Like Europe.
Great. Can't wait to check that out.
What have you been enjoying, Katie?
I picked up a recommendation from a couple of our listeners, actually, in our Patreon group on Facebook this week. Thank you so much to Britta and Paul who flagged this film up on the group. I watched the Swedish-directed Polish movie, Sweat. Have you heard about it?
No, I missed this one.
You must have missed that one when you were gallivanting about on the stage. It's about a Polish fitness influencer. You know those people who do like workout videos on Instagram and YouTube, and they've got like hundreds of thousands of followers.
Yeah, the ones that airbrush.
Well, not necessarily. It's about one of those people. And if I was going to put it really crudely, I'd say it is about a woman who does this as her job and the like stark contrast between the shiny, positive version of herself that she presents on her Instagram versus the reality, which is really pretty lonely. And there's some pretty grim things that happen to her. But actually, I think that saying that kind of downplays how good a film it is, because it sounds almost cliched in 2021 to say like, wait, you're telling me Instagram isn't reality? Influencers' lives aren't perfect?
Yeah, it does sound quite obvious.
Exactly. Everyone knows about that. But what I really like about this film is that it's really quite enigmatic and it doesn't force you into feeling one way or another about its lead character, this influencer. And she is a superb actor, Magdalena Kolesnik, who plays this woman. She is like enigmatic and powerful and vulnerable all at the same time. She also apparently trained like a machine for 18 months in order to convincingly play a fitness influencer, which I'm not really sure I'm up for. So don't ask me to do that. But yeah, without giving too much away, it is a lot more of an interesting film than a film about an influencer sounds. It's directed by Magnus von Horn, who is Swedish but moved to Poland to go to film school when he was like 21. And I think it's really worth your time. Just don't ask me where to find it online, because I found it really hard to work out what platform it's available in different countries. So apologies for that. But I rented it via Curzon in the UK.
A happy ending this week from Iceland, where the results are in from a large-scale experiment into reducing working hours, and for many people, even going down to a four-day week. And guess what? It turns out people were just as productive over 4 days as they were over five.
That does not surprise me one bit.
Nor me, and it makes me very happy. So let's all work less. And it's perhaps ironic because those of us working on this podcast seem to be working about 11-day weeks at the moment. And I do somehow wonder whether podcasting sadly defies this rule of fewer hours increasing productivity, but I really hope I can be proven wrong.
I hope so too.
Anyway, the trials in Iceland have led the unions to renegotiate working hours, and now 86% of the working population will be eligible to choose to reduce their hours for the same pay if they'd like to, which is pretty huge.
Amazing.
Happy days for the people of Iceland.
I am moving there straight away. Speaking of not working, next week is our last week before we take a little summer break, listeners. We are packing our buckets and spade and heading for the beach. Are we going to the beach?
That's very English of you.
I'm an English nationalist now.
I'd love to go to the beach. We're going to go foraging over the summer together, Katie, if the world lets us.
Yeah, I'm really excited. So if you have any last minute ideas for a guest that you'd really like to hear on the show, or an idea for Good Week, Bad Week, or like movies about fitness instructors that we should be talking about, we would love to hear them. You can email us at hello@europeanspodcast.com.
This episode was produced by Kat Laszlo, Priyanka Shankar and Andrei Popoviciu. This podcast is a member of the Are We Europe audio family. Go and check out their other lovely European offerings at areweeurope.eu/audio-family.
Have a great week, everyone, and commiserations to those of you who are no longer in the football, probably including us. Say us.
Bye.